Well, set of seven survey questions, and I promised you a result from that, collective result, so that you know what the questions are. Let me send around the sheets you filled out, and you won't get your own, but that's all right. If every other one takes one, then you can refer to the questions, and I'll give you the percentages of result compared to general public surveys in Western Europe and the United States. Just take one, any one, and pass them around so you can refer to the questions. The first one had to do with whether the economic ties between industrial or Western nations and developing nations are satisfactory as is, whether they benefit more the industrial countries, whether they benefit more the developing countries, or those three options. And as I would expect in a group like this, almost all of you said they benefit more the industrial countries. 94% had that opinion. 3%, which meant one person, said they're satisfactory, and one person said they benefit more the developing countries. Whereas in a similar poll in Western Europe, the percentages were like this. 28% said they're satisfactory as is, 38% said they benefit more the industrial countries, and 11% they benefit more the developing countries. Second question, about aid from the West to the developing world. Is it put to good use? 10% of you felt yes. This poll was taken also in France. In France, 35% thought the aid was put to good use. To bad use, 61% of you said bad. In France, it was only 27% who felt it was bad use. In this group, 29% had no opinion. In France, 38% had no opinion. Third question, is the gap being closed by economic assistance given to the developing countries from the North? To a large extent, none of you felt that was the case. Whereas in Western Europe, it was 14%. 61% of you said to a small extent. In Western Europe, that was 39%. Not at all, 33% of you said that, and 30% in Western Europe said not at all. The rest, a small percentage in each case, had no opinion. The international economic order in the next several years will stay as it is. 23% of you said yes to that. 33% said it will change to the benefit of the industrial countries. 43%, slight plurality, felt it would change to the benefit of the developing countries. Well, in Western Europe, in Western Europe, those percentages were 7, stay as is, 19, change to benefit industrial countries, 52% change to benefit developing countries. And then there were three questions about sacrifices or changes that we are prepared to make. Voluntary sacrifices, I take it that means that translates as more voluntary sharing. The great majority of you said yes, you would, roughly 3/4. 6% said no, 22% not sure or don't know. Well, we had similar figures from several European countries and the USA on that. I'll just give you the USA one. Similar question in the USA, 23% said yes, 60% said no, and 17% don't know. I don't know quite how to interpret that response for the U.S. because the next question is like it, and there was quite a different response. It may have been the whole context of the poll questions being asked. But on number 6, I would accept reduction in level of consumption and would avoid waste as the price of establishing more equal relations. 81% of you said yes, 1%, 3% said no, and 16% don't know. Well, when that question was asked in the U.S. public as a whole, 58% said yes, 33% no, and 9% not sure. The one about employment I threw in, that was not in any of the polls from Western Europe or the U.S., but I threw it in because I think that is going to come for some workers fairly soon in the Western countries. That's where you had the most serious division within this group. 43% said yes, 17% said no, and a whopping 40% said don't know, which I think is probably where we are. We aren't sure how we're going to respond to that. Okay, that's enough time on that. I also brought along this little clipping from Irma Bombeck, which I referred to somewhere a couple days ago, and I wanted to recall some more of the examples she gives. It's a light piece, but I think it makes a serious point, as she often does. This point is about the fact that we are all, it's in the context of energy waste, we are all appliance junkies. We are just addicted to labor-saving devices, small kitchen appliances, big lawn appliances, lawnmowers, snowblowers, even recreation vehicles. But she's talking about the kitchen appliances and what we may expect in the near future if the trend continues. It boggles the mind to predict what is in the future to satisfy the needs of the appliance junkie. It's my guess you should look for electric dental floss for people who can be putting on their socks and saving time. This one I mentioned, an automatic page turner for people who read in bed and their arms get cold when they're outside the covers. An automatic defroster for glasses when you're cooking and steam escapes when you take the lid off the pan. An electric cooler to blow your soup while you talk with your dinner partner. Well, if you don't have a chance to read Irma Bombeck regularly, you are among the Earth's deprived people. I appreciate the fact that this Bible study preceded what I have to share because it fits. It's really, in one way of looking at it, I think, about relinquishment, about the privileged relinquishing through the God wrestle or however, relinquishing a position that they have over the non-privileged. And Larry led us into that at the very end, and I want to try to pick it up as I go along in this material. The out-of-jointness, the disruption, the pain that comes as we talk about or hear about, think about, and get ready for a new way of ordering the international economy, because that is what is coming. And it's probably going to be done to us, not through us, we who are rich and who have been in charge. So what we're going to talk about in this hour is the demands of the poor nations who are ganging up, literally forming a labor union of the poor, against the rich, against the northern nations, the industrial world, which has been in charge, like Jacob. In this case, we've been in charge of the international trade system, the international economic order. We wrote the rules, and we still control most of the levers. But there is a new labor union of the poor emerging, which is saying, enough, the party's over, we won't have it that way anymore. And the only word you can apply to that is demand. They are no longer asking, they are demanding. That doesn't mean that next year they're going to be able to accomplish their demands, but the process is underway. It's often called the new international economic order, which I think is something of a misnomer, and I'll say why in a minute. But we're talking today about policy questions. What should the world do, specifically, to try to begin closing the gap, at least to stop it from growing further, which is what is still happening, and try to close it somewhat. Now, I think the United States, particularly, has trouble relating to call for changes which are basically economic. As long as the developing nations, the new nations post-World War II, the former colonies, were struggling for and getting political independence, political liberation, we could understand that and relate to it, and it wasn't particularly threatening to us as a nation. We, after all, had our own history of political revolution, of becoming an independent nation, once a colony. We understood that. Secondly, we didn't have many political colonies of our own. We didn't have a colonial empire like France, Portugal, Spain, Britain, even Germany for a while had a political empire, and even Denmark and Sweden and the Netherlands, small nations of Europe. We didn't have that history. We had a few colonies you could talk about, we still do perhaps, basically economic colonies. We didn't have an empire of political colonies. But when you talk about economic liberation, we are among the chief beneficiaries of the present system. To a large degree, we are, in recent times, the major architects of the present system. Now, it was begun by our European kin before we got into the game, but we have in latter times become major beneficiaries of the global economic system, the system of trade. And to a large extent, the economic colonies are ours, and they have produced substantial wealth for us. The present global economic order is an outgrowth of the trading patterns, and even more, the world distribution of labor. Who in the world does what? That was established during the period of political colonization, when the North controlled the South politically. The growth process, the growth in terms of Western-style development in the South, was induced from the outside. It did not basically grow up from within. Let me quote from Michael Harrington, one paragraph. Michael Harrington is the author of The Vast Majority, a look at the North-South economic relationship. Growth in the periphery, and the periphery in the way economists, international economists talk, the metropolis is the home base, the country, the colonial presence, London, Britain, in terms of India. Growth in the periphery would be South Asia, was stimulated by penetration of alien capital, outside capital coming in, to a stagnant economy, subsistence agriculture, often a feudal system. Only part of the society in the periphery was drawn into the web of monetary relations. Only part of the society got into a cash economy. The part that was brought to life to serve some of the specific needs of the metropolitan power, to serve the needs either market or job creation back home in Britain, not basically to serve the needs of Indians. I mean, Britain didn't occupy India in order to serve basically the needs of Indians. That may have been a byproduct, and there's some that say that did happen. Britain occupied India and all of South Asia to serve needs back home in Great Britain. If the peasant in this sector, in this newly westernized or developing sector, did acquire some cash, some buying power in the process, he did not spend it in the home market, which did not exist. There wasn't a place to spend your money at home because it wasn't a cash economy, basically. He had to import. And so there were goods coming in from Great Britain to meet that import need within that society. Within European or American capitalism, however, the exchange between city and countryside had a multiplier effect throughout the entire society as they mutually benefited one another. On the periphery, the city and the countryside were two different nations. That's the end of the quote. But you had a kind of enclave that was westernized with a major port city to handle goods both directions, going out and coming in, and maybe a little bit of hinterland around that port city that became developed and westernized and cash in a cash economy. But the great bulk of the Indian countryside was not a part of that. It was a separate nation. So the development which does occur in such a setting tends to benefit the economies of the already developed societies and the wealthy class within the low-income societies. There's a kind of first-world presence in the third-world countries. And that's true in every third-world country today. And they are, in fact, relatively richer than our rich in the United States compared to our poor. They are really the first world in the third world, and their natural alliances are not with fellow Indians who are poor, but with us. Their natural alliances, their tastes, their needs, their greeds, their desire for luxury goods is very much like ours. And there is more incentive for them, the wealthy within India, and by the way, within India, that's a pretty sizable group. I have read that it is as large as 5% of the Indian population who are quite wealthy, and that is 30 million people. That's a first world nation within India. But they have more incentive to spend their gains on importing consumer goods from the North consumer goods that we make than to invest in the South for internal development. Thus, the underdeveloped societies, and this is the major point that I want to make here, the underdeveloped societies are not internally coherent, as are the economies of the North. They are dependent on economic decisions and market forces outside themselves. Transnational corporations, or however you want to view that. Often, those developing societies, now to a degree westernizing, are worse off than before the external development started. For example, large-scale use of land in many southern nations now used to grow crops for export to us, which in an earlier time was used to grow food for the people who lived there. Why does that happen? It's not because you and I are particularly malicious when we go to the grocery store and want fresh tomatoes year-round, tomatoes that are grown in the wintertime in Mexico on land that once grew beans or corn, maize for Mexicans. It's because the market forces satisfy and make more profitable that use of the land than to grow land for poor Mexicans, or to grow corn or beans for poor Mexicans. When I was growing up in rural Iowa in the 30s and 40s, we did not have fresh tomatoes year-round, nor did we expect them. Today we do tend to expect fresh fruits and vegetables, in fact, anything we darn well want, all the time. And we've got the money to pay for it. And the world market responds, because that's an effective demand. And the demand of poor Mexicans who live on that land, probably as tenant farmers, that's not an effective demand for the use of that land. Well, that's just one small example. Another is, again, to go to India. The U.S. economy is basically a product of our own history. We were colonized for a while, but that didn't last long. And once we took over, we basically developed our own land, our own resources to meet needs domestically. India today is not like that. India had a well-developed textile industry 200 and more years ago, until England came in and wiped it out. Now, why did England wipe it out? England wiped it out because England had workers who wanted to work in the mills with cotton and other fibers from India. So India continued to produce raw materials, but not to process the raw material into textile fabrics in cottage industry, which India once had. Britain eliminated that, so that workers who were British in citizenship could do that work. And then you had the phenomenon, the anomaly of raw material from Britain being shipped, from India being shipped to Britain into the Midlands where all those mills were, being manufactured into processed product there and some of it shipped back to India. And that kind of example with raw materials processed in the North to employ in the industrial sector after the Industrial Revolution, to employ workers in the North, and then to meet the market needs in the North, some of it being shipped back to the South. You have that example all over the world. And a lot of that we just take for granted as though that's the way it always has been. Well, it hasn't always been that way. Now, the new nations, recognizing that their needs and the gap are not going to be dealt with by more aid, have been saying increasingly in the last half decade, they've come together in the last 5 years, that more aid from the North to the South is not the answer. You see the slogan sometimes, trade, not aid. That means we're talking not about additional charity from the North, which the North decides whether or not to give. Each year we make a decision anew on whether we're going to extend more aid this time, and all the industrial nations have been doing that. It's in the area of trade. What they're really saying is justice, not charity. Or system change, rather than our reliance on what benevolence you choose to extend to us this year. One reason the trade hasn't been very adequate is it's been limited in actual transfer of resource. It hasn't been very great. In addition to that, most of it has been tied. The aid that the United States gives, some question whether you should even call it aid or whether you should call it a gift. Most of it has been loan, long-term, low interest, less than market rate loans, but nevertheless loans that incur debt to be paid back. And most of it is tied. That means it has to be spent within the United States economy. We'll give you money if you buy American with it. And the low-income countries resent that greatly, partly because it is tied, partly because it doesn't help them to have the flexibility to use it in ways that would be most meaningful for their own development. So, what is the new international economic order? It is not really very new. It is still within the present market system, and it is basically a conservative approach. It is certainly not a socialist plot. It is not saying we ought to replace market capitalism with socialism. It is still within the world market system. It's really asking that it be allowed to work better for the poor by making some modifications, which in fact would have a fairly substantial effect on us, and therefore we've been resisting it, but wouldn't basically change the international market system. It is within that system, therefore I would say it's a conservative approach. It's a reform rather than a new order. So I think it's somewhat misnamed. But it has come to be called the New International Economic Order. It is basically a debate between the first and third worlds, or the third and fourth worlds and the first world. The socialist economies are almost entirely outside the debate, largely because they've been outside the patterns of international trade to a large extent. And they don't have the international economic institutions, the multinational corporations that the first world has. It's a north-south struggle, which is replacing the east-west struggle as the conflict that is at center stage for the world. It does not deal at all, and this is another reason why it's conservative, it doesn't deal at all with the internal reforms that have to occur within developing countries. That problem of distribution of wealth within India that I referred to, or within Brazil. Brazil has had a great economic growth in the last decade, but it has benefited roughly half the people, and the other half are poorer, relatively poorer than they were before. The new international economic order is purely international, between nations, has nothing to do with internal reforms that are also needed. That's another whole subject. Further, it doesn't deal with the basic north-south dependency relationship. It doesn't essentially change that, but it is a start, and it is an important start because all of the poor nations can agree on it. That probably is the most remarkable thing about this agenda. 112 or something like that, low-income nations have all agreed on this agenda. It came to the world's attention through a remarkable unanimity of low-income countries who have been pressing through the UN system, inspired by OPEC, inspired by the increase in oil prices of 1973, to go and do likewise with other commodities that we need and that they have to sell. So beginning in 1974 and through special sessions of the UN in 74, 75, and a number of specialized conferences ever since that are still going on, the negotiations are going forward. It begins, as I said, with the premise that aid is not the answer, but structural changes in the economic relationships between North and South. What are they? Well, there are a lot of points. There are six major ones, as I see it, which I want to briefly outline for you. And then I want to say something about the role of the church in the rich world in all of this. And then we'll talk about it, see how you feel about it. I've put up on the two side pillars material which not all of you can see, but I'm going to refer to it, and you can go and look at the data afterward if you can't see it from where you sit. The first one has to do with the terms of trade. That means how much rubber should a German tractor cost Malaysia? It's about parity. We hear about parity from American farmers again these days. They're talking about purchasing power. How much do they get for what they have to sell in relation to what they have to buy? The poor nations are talking about that because in the last 15 years, their parity with the industrial nation products that they must buy has gone like this. I mean, the cost of industrial products goes up, the cost of the raw materials they basically have to sell to the world market have either remained at a plateau or have declined. In relative terms, they have declined. How much U.S. wheat will Bangladesh jute buy in 1979? It's that kind of question. Because of a lot of factors, the increase of wages, the increase of petroleum, the industrial product costs have been going up rather rapidly. But the raw material prices have not been going up. There are three examples over there, I think. Rubber in Malaysia, sisal in Tanzania, and tea in Sri Lanka. The preliminary thing you need to know is that 12 major commodities, metals, foods, agricultural products, and fibers, basically, account for 80% of the export earnings of the 112 low-income countries. 80% of their international exchange comes from 12 commodities. Copper, tin, sisal, jute, tea, coffee, cocoa. That does not, sugar is a big one. That does not include oil, because the oil producing countries are no longer considered low income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. The other point there is that the producers in the low income countries, that is what the low income countries receive for that product, is $30 billion a year. This was last year's figure. When those raw materials are processed, transported, packaged, advertised, and marketed to the final consumer in the North or anywhere in the world, they sell for $200 billion. So that 6/7 of the value added accrues to somebody else. It's very much like the American farmer who says, hey, don't blame me if the price of bread goes up. I get 3 cents out of that 50-cent loaf of bread. Somebody else is getting the bulk of the value added. Well, it's the same with the low-income countries. Now, that varies from commodity to commodity. But overall, they get $30 billion for what we buy at $200 billion. And so most of the labor that goes into it, all of the shipping, and most of the value added that comes along the way, all the middle persons, are our middle persons, are our economies benefiting. We own the shipping lines and so on. They may fly under Liberian and Panamanian flags, but they're owned by Greeks and Americans and Britishers. Okay, you see that point. One of the proposals for changing this terms of trade problem is called indexation. That is tying the costs of a market basket of imports for the low-income countries that come from the North to the value of the exports that they ship to the North or ship anywhere. It is very much like a cost of living index built into a labor contract, which we know within our domestic context. Is it inflationary? Of course it is. But it is inflation that is crippling the economies of low-income countries, wiping out any gains they make each year. And they're asking that they not have to bear all the burden of international inflation. And if there's going to be inflation, then the price they get for their copper and tin and bauxite and so on should also go up as the price of the oil and the price of the tractor goes up. All right, that's point one. The terms of trade have been unfair, grossly unfair, and getting worse. Secondly, the processing of raw materials. The fact that only $30 billion out of $200 billion accrues to the low-income country results in part from tariff arrangements which effectively discourage them from processing their own stuff. We don't say absolutely no, you can't do it. We simply have tariffs that discourage them from doing it. Now, there are some examples of tariffs over on this column. There's basically no tariff against raw materials that we import from the southern world. There's a substantial tariff in many cases as soon as they are processed. I think the example of cocoa from Ghana is there. And what's the country that is importing?
Japan.
No tariff on cocoa beans. Ghana relies for export of cocoa beans for over half of its international exchange. What is the figure for for cocoa powder? 30% tariff?
Yeah. Yeah.
And for chocolate products, 35%. Now, that's not only Japan. It's West Germany. It's the United States. It's Netherlands. It's Switzerland. Wherever there's a chocolate industry. Those countries don't grow the cocoa beans. Ghana does. West African countries, basically. But those countries have the workers in that industry, and they want to keep their jobs. It's understandable. If we eliminated the tariff on processed cocoa, there'd be some distress in Hershey, Pennsylvania, without a doubt. It's that kind of thing. We think that's entirely legitimate. Protectionism makes sense within our own economy. The low-income countries say it's grossly unfair. and it keeps them tied in forever to the biblical category of being drawers of water and hewers of wood for the rich world. They say, forever we're going to be only the producers of raw materials for you guys. And your workers are going to have the benefit of making into something usable what we grow or mine. Well, we've been going the other way lately. More protectionism in the United States. Color television sets, shoes, textiles, things that are made elsewhere by cheaper labor, competing with our own labor. And there's great pressure on our Congress and on our administration to raise either tariff barriers or quotas on how much we will import. That's a major problem.
How does the auto industry now fit into that, Chuck?
There basically have not been tariffs in the United States on auto importation. I don't know why, but there haven't been. I guess because we want to sell our cars, too. See, tariffs are a kind of a two-edged sword, and American farmers basically have been opposed to tariffs on industrial products because if we are too protective with processed stuff coming in, then we can't sell our agricultural export in other countries. The classic capitalist argument is free trade is the best of all worlds, and let every country do what it can most efficiently do, either grow or manufacture, because tariff barriers tend to create tariff barriers. You know, the elimination of tariffs that has gone on in the last half century has been basically within the rich man's club. There are a lot of tariff agreements now between us and Western Europe, between us and Japan, but it hasn't extended north-south, and that's the new area of debate. The third area of negotiation is commodity agreements. For price stabilization, the poor nations are talking about a common fund, which would buy up buffer stocks, very much like the grain reserve that the United States has created and other nations are talking about. When the price is low, you buy up buffer stocks, like in Joseph's Egypt, remember? Joseph's Genesis story. When the price then is high because the demand is greater than the supply, then you can release the buffer stocks. And it's a way of stabilizing price within a band. It also tends to give assurance on the part of the North that we will continue to buy from the South what they have to sell us, that we won't turn to synthetic substitutes. We will sign long-term agreements to buy a certain amount of bauxite, a certain amount of copper, a certain amount of coffee. And this would all be managed through some, what seems to me, rather complicated common fund that would finance the buying of buffer stocks. We've done that kind of thing unilaterally or bilaterally with Russia. We have signed a wheat agreement with Russia in the last year or so, that Russia will buy from us a certain number of million metric tons of wheat per year for a certain number of years. Well, it's that kind of thing with all of these commodities that the poor nations are asking for. Four, the conduct of transnational corporations. They're asking for a code which would govern the behavior of the transnationals. There is no body of international law now that governs it. The only law that governs their behavior is their host country or their home country law, which is rather minimal for their operations overseas, and in some of the poor countries, each nation doing its own thing, some law that governs their behavior there. But there is no internationally agreed code of conduct. How much profit can they export? Can they take out? Should there be a ceiling on that? How much local control should there be of the subsidiary of the corporation operating within Peru? What about their hiring and wage practices? And I suppose the toughest issue of all, the transfer of technology. Is there some way of managing the transfer of technology which the corporations are primarily responsible for, so that bad, inappropriate technology from the North is not implanted into the infrastructure of the South in a way that, well, is too energy or machinery intensive and not human labor intensive, for example? What is appropriate? People don't really agree on that. It varies from country to country, but it's a major area of debate. The poor countries currently have to pay in royalties for inventions or processes which the Northern World corporations own, $3 to $5 billion a year. They pay to us because we develop the technology. They pay royalty or licensing fees amounting to that much money. That's probably something that most Americans aren't even aware of. It's called intellectual property. how you do things. A fifth area is debt relief. Some countries now spend one-third to one-half of their annual trade earnings on debt retirement, much of it to pay off long-term loans, which was the aid of an earlier era. Now, that's why I say that aid isn't really aid, it's long-term loan. And it probably was at lower interest rates than they could have gotten on the regular market, but it still has to be paid back. They're asking for either a moratorium, that is a temporary cessation of the repayment schedule, or refinancing. Some Western countries in the past year have forgiven debt to particular low-income countries that were sorely pressed. They were Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands. We didn't like that. The United States didn't like that because we said that set a bad example. I suppose it shames us too a little bit. If you forgive that debt, you have to use tax dollars to pay off the private investors who very often hold the debt, hold the loan. So debt relief is a major issue, and how to handle that is being negotiated. A sixth one is kind of a special case, but I think it's a parable, and I want to share it. It's the law of the sea. This doesn't have to do with the offshore fishing rights. It has to do with the mineral wealth in the deep sea, where there are nodes of metals that are very rich, and they are metals that in many cases we're running out of from land mining. Nickel and copper and
magnesium.
There are four or five metals that are found on the ocean beds, which we have the technology to develop. The poor nations do not. We have the capital to develop. We have the ships. We have the workers who know how to do that. And we propose to go and do it. There is legislation in our Congress right now. It has to be dealt with by the U.S. Congress because it's in international waters. There's an attempt to reach international agreement on how that shall be done. Not who shall do it. Everybody agrees it's the industrial world that knows how to do it. But who will benefit from it? And will the benefits be shared in any kind of equitable way? Or will the exploitation of that resource also accrue to the benefit of the rich world, the already rich world? Some of the things they're talking about are an international tax, maybe 1% of the gross value of all that is mined, that would go into a fund to fuel the development of low-income countries. Well, we haven't yet agreed to that, and the other rich nations haven't either. It's almost like we're saying we're not yet rich enough. We can't yet let some of the profit of some of the resource of the planet accrue to the poor countries. We aren't yet ready to say that. And by the way, the idea of an international income tax or some kind of international tax has been talked about being applied in many different places. You could put a tax on all the goods that move out of the poor countries, a special tax, or all the activity in the ports of the world that would accrue to the low-income countries for their economic development. Some kind of international tax system which would get the aid beyond the category of aid and into the category of dependable revenue is probably going to come in the, I would say, before the end of the century. Now, all of these points are asking that the rich North relinquish, let go, some of the advantages we won through the colonial period and the evolution of the present trade patterns. And that we do this for the sake of a redistribution of access to resources, which leads to accumulation of wealth. The NIEO is not a complete answer, but it is one part of reordering the planet system. And I think we had better begin to take it seriously because the poor nations are very serious about it. This has become their major platform in the international debate. Well, what leverage do they have? They don't have a great deal, but they do have some leverage. They have an outright majority now in the United Nations, a majority which we increasingly resent. It's a thin reed, maybe, to have a majority in the UN, but it's still important. It has symbolic importance as a shaper of world opinion. And I think it means something that Julius Nyerere of Tanzania and the military dictators of capitalist Brazil agree on this agenda, along with 110 other nations. They have, secondly, some resources that are essential to our way of life, or that we think are essentials. In addition to oil, it's metals and some non-essentials that we want. We don't have to have coffee, and if the price gets too high, we will curb our consumption somewhat. Tea, bananas, we don't have to have those things. But we have a very low threshold for disruption in the rich world. We don't like to have our normal patterns of life disrupted. And history says we're willing to pay nearly anything, a fairly high price, to avoid having our style of life modified. I think that's an advantage to the poor nations. Our experience with oil demonstrates that. If it doesn't go up 3 or 4 to 1 within 1 month, we get used to the adjustment upward. The price of petroleum at the pump has nearly doubled in the last 4 years, and we've gotten used to it, and it's going to go up some more, and we'll accept it, and we probably won't curb our consumption very much, unless we pass laws ourselves to do that. I think that's an advantage for the poor world in this debate, our low threshold for disruption. Then they have a moral case that's compelling and persuasive with many people, including many, though still a small minority, many within the northern countries, within the rich world. It includes a growing number of educators, moral leaders, some economists, even a few politicians, although I think the politicians are going to be the last ones to champion this agenda. They will respond to it if pressed by their constituency. And I think we're in the process now of developing an informed constituency in this country, Europe, Canada, etc. Finally, I think there's a growing sense that the self-interest of all of us on Spaceship Earth requires some adjustments in the international system, a major attempt to close the gap, just as Americans after World War II were willing to do the Marshall Plan for two basic reasons. One, it was the compassionate and necessary thing to do to help rebuild the devastated economies of our former enemies and friends. Secondly, it was in our own self-interest to do so because we needed that market. For the economy of the United States to be healthy, we needed the market of Western Europe and, as it has turned out, Japan, to sell things to. I think we will come to see it's in our self-interest long run also that the poor nations of the world be better able to be a market for what we have to sell them. Right now, the poorest of this earth cannot buy our wheat. And we have an excess of wheat to sell to somebody, and nobody's buying it, and that depresses the price. Well, our farmers would be much happier if the poor could, if they choose to do so, buy more of our wheat, and in return get a higher price, have to require a higher price for what they have to sell us. The United States is in the strange position of being a major exporter not only of industrial or processed goods, but also of raw materials, because of our agriculture. Most rich world countries do not export a major quantity of raw material as we do. Okay, something about what we can do about it. I don't think there is a great deal we can do about it because it's being done to us, and that's kind of a new ball game. We're used to being in the role of the problem solvers. We'll do more aid, or we'll send more technological assistance. This one is being done to us. There are still some things, however, that we can do to relate to that new reality, and one is to try to understand it, to understand the need for the structural changes that are being called for. It's been said, and I think it's true, that the United States is the least developed nation in the world in terms of global understanding, the least developed wealthy nation, certainly. Western Europeans and Canadians, Australians generally are better informed overall about the international system and about international development. Secondly, there are certain kinds of political support that we can give. We can show that we're willing to elect and sustain politicians who will vote with global responsibility in mind. And there aren't many of them, and there aren't many constituents in this country who are giving that evidence. But movements like Bread for the World are trying to gather those people together and to show that there is a focus to their thoughts, their political activity. Third, I think we certainly need to prepare ourselves to live with a somewhat reduced standard of living, if standard of living means quantity of consumption. As the price is one of the prices of greater justice. Elizabeth Seton's comment, the rich must live more simply that the poor may simply live. And that brings me to a final comment about the role of the church. I think the church's role in all of this is primarily educator, sensitizer, consciousness changer, and perhaps ethical guide to look at the international human community and not just the domestic U.S. community as the concern of the people of God. I think the main role of the church as the changes start to come is going to be in ministering to people who think that the American dream has somehow betrayed them. They've bought the idea that there is a constant increase in level of consumption as a divine right for the Americans, or for the Westerners, or for the North Atlantic peoples. And when that starts to decline, or even to plateau, people are going to feel that somehow they've been betrayed. And some of them will blame God, some of them will blame those who are calling for and advocating these changes, but people will be in distress. And I think the question for the church is, how do you minister to people who feel that the no of limits is bad news rather than good news? How do you say, hey folks, that can be good news, that can be a gospel liberating word, which is really the theme of John Taylor's Enough is Enough. Well, I had better quit there. I've gone on too long. I think we have 10 or 15 minutes to discuss all of this. Where do you want to pick it up? Yes?
I just wanted to relate way back in your talk when you were speaking of England taking over the textile industry of India. And just a small example of this, in Western Washington, the lumber industry is a big industry. And there's a lot of trees to be cut down, but also the making of commercial products and lumber and so forth, the wood products from this lumber is a big industry. And more and more, Japan is buying the logs, taking them all the way across the ocean, using these logs to make lumber products, shipping them back to Washington and selling the finished product cheaper than what it could be manufactured in Washington. Yeah. I mean, it's the reverse kind of thing of what you were talking about.
Yeah.
But oh, are the people unhappy? The loss of jobs and the labor unions, management, the whole works. And
we're going to see more of that kind of thing. The purchase of Midwest agricultural land by non-U.S. investors is really upsetting to Midwesterners and Midwest farmers particularly. And yet we've been doing the same kind of thing in the poor countries for centuries, buying up, or at least the right to use, their land. Most of Central America, the most productive land, is owned by corporations that are based in North America for growing bananas or sugar or whatever we want. So the same kind of thing is now starting to happen to us.
Yeah.
The other thing that occurs to me is, I was up in Alaska a year ago, and they were talking about it was a food and international economics conference. And they were talking about the sense in which they feel like a colony of Washington and Seattle, particularly, because the pattern of development for Alaska, including their fisheries, has been Seattle-oriented. Seattle was the metropolis for Alaska, and I guess still is, to a large extent. And we were talking about the general absence of seafood offered in Alaskan restaurants. And there, you know, there were no great seafood restaurants there, and I was remarking about that, and the absence of seafood in the daily diet of Anchorage people. And they said, well, that's because our fisheries, our seafood, which is fished in our waters, goes down to Seattle, gets packed there, or processed there, or frozen, and then is shipped out across the United States, and some of it back to Alaska. But it becomes very costly because it has to go to Seattle and back.
That's another big problem at the moment, because is it the Russian-run company that have these big processing ships?
Russians and Japanese.
Just Japanese,
yeah.
Right. Just
offshore. Yeah.
That can process this fish cheaper than it to be brought to shore. I mean, it's a
Makes us mad, though, because those are the rules of the game that we set.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
That's what we made us so mad when OPEC did the same thing that we've been doing for a generation.
Yes, Mary?
This probably sounds naive, but you know, I won't buy tomatoes And when you say there isn't anything we can really do, I think if there was an absolute boycott of venison, for example, buying tomatoes and
oh, yeah.
It wouldn't even work.
Yeah. The problem... Yeah, and that kind of boycott is very hard to organize, Mary, because immediately people will say, and there's some truth in it, if you stop buying what they're selling to us, you hurt their economy. In the short term, you do, because it provides, it creates a disjunction in their economy. And, you know, and so it's...
Yes, but a very small percentage of people are betting.
That's right, right.
The peasant's land has been taken away, and they're starving, and you know, the trickle-down theory just doesn't work.
Yes, that's all true. But I'm just saying it's hard under any circumstances to get an effective boycott, consumer boycott going. I think it's especially hard when there is that counter-argument that if you don't buy what the poor nations have to sell us, you're hurting them even more. It's a little like the argument in Southern Africa that if we withdraw our investments there, the blacks will be the first ones to be hurt. Well, there's a little truth in that, and yet most of the black leaders are now saying, don't worry about us, we're being hurt under the present system. We can handle it.
They're saying that we're willing to be hurt even more,
yes,
if the change is major.
But I think that's a worthwhile thing to do, Mary. Did you say you are doing that, or you contemplate?
I have not bought tomatoes in the winter time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize where our winter tomatoes came from, but
that's where they come from, by and large. Nyla?
I think that the education part is so important, you know, what Mary was saying about the tomatoes. The thing about Ugandan coffee, you know, I did not know.
Yeah.
Folgers coffee is, what, half Ugandan coffee. I did not know about the Nestle thing with the...
Infant formula.
Infant formula. And, you know, I think that's so important, and that's what ought to be in the pages of our church magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kind of thing, that people are aware of where this stuff comes from.
Yeah. Right.
Are you familiar with, I'm sure you are, the Interfaith Council on
Corporate Responsibility?
Yeah.
Yes.
I saw a film strip by them called Guess Who's Coming to Breakfast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now,
Sugar and Dominican Republic, that deals
it's
with.
It's got to be emotionally.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, are there more things like that coming out? Because that was the first thing I'd ever heard about, you know, the sugar thing with Dominican sugar.
Yeah.
There are. Boycott Dominican sugar, but I didn't know about the tomatoes, and I didn't know about the coffee, you know.
There's, in fact, in the village, a resource that we hope to be able to show some evening next week for those who are interested. It's called Sharing Global Resources. It's a slideshow with sound that deals with the U.S.-Latin America relationship around a number of products and even the political... It talks about Chile and copper and the interplay of U.S. corporations, Kennecott, Anaconda, the CIA, the overthrow of the Allende government, our U.S. government aid to Chile before and after and during. It's got all that stuff documented. How the policies of our government and the policies of our corporations and the politics and economics of a rather small country like Chile intermesh. Because the copper development of Chile historically has been done by U.S.-based companies. And the Allende attempt for 4 years to keep resources within Chile and to keep Chileans in control of their own resources. Our government opposed, and our corporations understandably opposed. And it's pretty well documented now that we had, officially as a nation, a great deal to do with the overthrow of that government, because what it was doing was not in our interests. And it wasn't just because it was Marxism versus capitalism. It was, I think, more basic than that. Well, we hope to show that next week sometime. So for those who are in the village next week, it'll be announced if we can get it arranged. There are resources like that coming out. This one was produced by the American Friends Service Committee, Quaker-related organization. The one you refer to deals with Dominican Republic and Gulf and Western, an American corporation that owns most of the best land there for producing sugar.
Let me give you an example, though, of the dilemma. You quoted from Michael Harrington's The Vast Majority, which is about as well-stated a case as has been made about the external factors for the poor world's poverty, that is, the relationship to the rich world. That appeared in an excerpt in Christianity in Crisis. And here you have just this cutting expose of our complicity in the poor world's poverty. Down at the bottom of the page, it noted where this excerpt was coming from. Michael Harrington, The Vast Majority, published by, what was the name of the press?
Simon and Schuster.
Simon and Schuster, a division of Gulf and Western, which is the largest multinational corporation in the world. Now, how does Michael Harrington get his word out except by way of Gulf and Western? I mean, that's just a...
Well, everywhere you turn, we're all involved every hour in the same system.
Yeah.
So nobody has clean hands.
Yeah.
John?
I know you want to go to coffee. I think an interesting one on the Mexico and tomatoes is the carnations. The owners of the land make 80 times what they could make growing food by growing carnations,
yeah,
because we like our ushers in the winter to have flowers.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. We have fresh flowers in our floral shops also because of Mexican land being available to us. Yeah,
that's right. I think, like she's saying, we have to take the responsibility. We have to change our lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, it isn't easy to do it.
That's right.
And I'm from the Midwest. I'm a farmer. Mm. We're sitting on thousands of tons of coal.
Yeah.
And we're being exploited the same as...
We've got to have a session on U.S. farmers. And
are you here next week?
We'll be here Friday.
We hope to do that some night next week.
Yeah.
How U.S. farmers are in a similar position to the third world nations.
A lot of the dynamics.
They both produce raw material and they can't control the price.